Warren Lusky joins us via Zoom at 10:15. It is our Heritage Half Hour. Welcome, Warren. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Clarence. Thank you very much. And good morning to you.
Yes.
As you well know, it's good evening to me. And if we have this problem, I'm sitting with my son, Dana.
You're sitting with your son, Dana. You lucky man. What's the weather like on your side?
It's a stunning autumnal evening. Stunning. Absolutely. But yeah. I'm happy to join the conversation.
Yeah, no, and we really chuffed about this opportunity to chat with you. I'm sure you miss Cape Town, Warren.
Always, always. In my mind, I'm always there.
So why are you there?
That's where home is. That's where the heart is, you know.
No, I'm saying why are you there and not here if you're always here?
If I knew the answer to that question, the short answer is I don't have an answer. I'm here, but I'm also there. Maybe it's my split personality. I've got multiple personalities.
Why did you choose to go to Australia in the first place?
Very, very long story. It involves my job. It involves family. I made the decision. I have regrets. I can't lie. There are lots of things that keeps me spiritually in Cape Town. But the reality is I'm here. You know, you play with what you don't, and that's my story. Still long a story to go.
Was it the prospect of a better life? Was it in response maybe to the apartheid politics at the time that you had left this country?
It was almost certainly the apartheid politics at the time. You must remember I worked in the media. I won't say it was black media because it was white owned. But black nonetheless, because we were pitched at the black community, the colored community specifically. And around 86, well, from the time I started in 67, the media, the colored black media, was always under scrutiny from the system. And it became quite apparent in the 80s that we were even more so being scrutinized, being watched by the apparatus of the state. In the mid 80s, Cape Town, the rest of the country was alike. And even in the media, we had activists. So, we became under the watchful eye of, people like Lieutenant Francois Mostert. I'll never forget him and his limpid blue eyes.
Why won't you forget this lieutenant?
He was almost omnipresent, at the Cape Herald at the time. You walk out the front of the building, he's sitting there, and you walk out of your house at 8 o'clock in the morning to travel to Cape Town, he's outside just watching. He was almost like, dare say, almost like a family member at the Cape Herald.
Was he watching you, or was he watching all of the Cape Herald?
Everybody. You must remember, some of the people that worked with me, worked for me, Ryland Fisher, Anis Ali, Muhsin Williams, Tyron Seale. These were all guys who were pretty active at the time. Some of them more active as community activists than as media types. So it was a no-brainer for the security police to watch us.
Okay, so Warren has been in talks with the elders. So he's been interviewing a lot of the musical icons that have come from Cape Town. And there's some very interesting discoveries that you'll make about their lives in Warren Lutsky's writing. Somebody just written here on our WhatsApp page, Warren just left Cape Town 2 weeks ago. I suspect it could have been a cheaper call if we called you 2 weeks ago then, Warren. How often are you coming down here?
Ideally, I'd like to come every year. It's almost like a rejuvenation, you know. The first thing I do when I get to Cape Town and I get wheels, I go up to where I was born in Newlands and I look at the mountain and I think I would have had a wonderful time just spending my life here. It lifts the soul just being in the shadows of that, in the bosom of that edifice.
Yeah. You've also been active in the establishment of the Khamisa Museum at the castle, were you not?
I did. They called on me to do a bit of editing, the stuff, just a little bit, mind you, but where I can, I help out. The brain is, I think, still active. And even though I've retired now 10 odd years, I have the fingers in the pie in a lot of things in Cape Town. I am a volunteer with Play Sport for Life, which is an NPO that works in the community. I do their media relations. I blog on Trafalgar High, as you well know. There's a nice story for you to follow up there, which you can talk about later. And of course, my blog, which is Music Legends of Cape Town. And I talk to what I term the elders, the musicians of the 60s and 70s who are retired. Some of them have passed on, and their stories have never been told. I think it's just, I fill the void in that respect in terms of the history of music in Cape Town.
Yeah, and if it wasn't for you, their stories would remain untold. What made you embark on this mission of listening, talking to the elders, and recording this history?
Well, I retired around 2011, 2012. I forget now, but when I came to Australia, I had a box full of photographs that started when I started writing about entertainment in 67. And I kept all, I'm a classic hoarder. I don't throw things away. So I had all these photographs, I had negatives, and I also had all my clippings. And I thought one day I was like, I should, let me find something on. And I just chose, I don't know why, I chose Jack Monplaith, because I was always very friendly with him and his family. And when they came from Durban, I couldn't find anything on the internet. And then I started looking for others. And I found on this website, on that website, and I thought, this is ridiculous. You can't go to 10 websites to find people. So I thought, how about if I started something and I have the ability to write, I think, and design, and I'm not, I'm quite cluey with technology. So I just started writing, and Jack, strangely enough, was the first article I wrote in November 2014. And now I have almost 100 pages of articles on that website. And most of them I have spoken to over the phone, via email, via WhatsApp. There's only one interview I did live, face to face, and that, strangely enough, was with Stephen Erasmus, who was the bassist with so many bands,
What a
and he's
crazy
not a
man.
well man.
Yeah, what a
He's not a well
crazy man. Oh, Stephen
man.
Erasmus, I love Stephen. But I'm looking just at the interviews that you've had. There's Talib Peterson, there's Terry Fortune, there is just Eldred Skilder, Molly Baron, they're just Sophia Foster. These are incredible musicians that this city has delivered to the world. Is it purely a so-called colored take on music that you're seeking to tell the story of?
No. I'm quite conscious of the fact that I don't know if it will be labeled that. I try to get a diversity in all the people that I interview. And I hate to go down this road, but there are Africans. There's one like Anna Minnaar. I don't look at it in that way at all. These are just musicians. The reality is Cape Town is predominantly so-called colored community, and that's where the majority of the things are. And my job is made much easier because most of them sort of grew up with me. I know them personally. They are friends of 50 years. People like Leslie and Richard John Smith, Molly, the late Molly. I know them, I know their lives. I could write easily without having to delve too deep into their life story.
So it is your
And
social history, your social history enables this kind of content that you've brought forth.
yes, it's a lived experience. I hung out with these guys. I was a nightclub junkie. I was a nightclub junkie. I just four or five nightclubs in one night. I used to go and listen to the bands. And I know their stories. It's interesting. I can write these things. There's so much material to write about. There's just not enough time to do it. Yeah, I think there's an opportunity for somebody to do a bio on Richard John Smith or on Jonathan Butler, on Dollar Brand, on Abdullah Ibrahim. There's an opportunity. I can't believe there's just one book on a Cape Town artist, and that's Paula Fleury's book on Tali Peterson. And I don't want to put tickets on myself, but she used a lot of my material on the blog to write her book. There's a guy in Belgium, Milton van Wyk. He's doing his PhD on the Golden State Pixies, and he did his master's on Basil Tutsi, and they acknowledge that they got material from my blog, and I'm really chuffed about that. I mean, this is just it's not even, it's not a side hustle. You hustle, you make money. There's no money involved in what I'm doing here.
Well, it's such an
I do it
important.
because I love.
It's such an important job that you've done, and you can find the writings on warrenludskimusicscene.com. Warren Ludski, Ludski. Warrenludskimusicscene.com. I was chatting to Terry Fortune on Friday. He's talking about a book that he's launching, and I'm like, Terry, it is so important that you tell this story, and I'm excited about that, which is in the offing. Were there any kind of standout stories that you think we need to know of, in terms of the very many people that you've spoken to?
Man, they all have such interesting stories to tell. But if I had to pick one that's different, it's the story of Ira Wagner, the blind guitarist of the Big Beats. I mean, this man was a phenomenal human being. He's totally blind. He rides a bike. He works with power tools. He leaves Cape Town. He goes to London. He studies to be a barrister. But he's such a phenomenal musician and with a perfect ear. I don't see Ivor for 20 years, and then he's in Cape Town, and I spot him in the street, and I shout,
Wow.
"Hey, Ivor!" And in 1 second, he says, "Is that you, Warren?"
Wow.
It just blew me away. But yeah, he's one of them as that stands out. Now, Molly Baron for his frankness, David Bestman. You know, I talk to these guys, and they say, "Please don't write about all the children that you fought."
I got a message in from Leslie Claidsmith via WhatsApp. It reads, Warren Ludski is a walking encyclopedia when it comes to the music scene in Cape Town and beyond. He supported us from his days at the Post to the Cape Herald. He still supports us even from afar. In what form does that support take?
If they have, in the past, whatever it was, that if there was a show coming to town, the first stop, the Flames, biggest group South Africa's produced, their first stop, Steve Pataa would call me, "Warren, can we have a chat?" Molly Baron, when they come back from Namibia or wherever they're touring, I'd get a phone call, "Warren, we're hitting town, can we have a chat?" I get people, there's a woman at Pennsylvania University gave me a call out of the blue. She said, "Sylvia Vollenhove told her, if you want to know about the music, talk to Warren." I get strange calls, and they talk, and my wife gets the shits with it because she says, "You're retired, just leave it, let it go." But I can't, Clarence, I can't. I once interviewed a DJ, a radio DJ. I thought that was an interesting one with his dulcet tones. I think his name was Clarence.
Yeah, listen, I just think that this is such an important job that you've taken on, and this information now resides there in the ether for posterity, for people to reflect on this very rich history of creativity that we've seen during the dark days of apartheid, especially. It was amazing. And often these artists would keep the flames of, you know, cultural expression, but also the flames of anti-apartheid activism alive. It was the go-to kind of space to replenish, especially in those decades. And, you know, a greater tribute could not have been done. So a big thank you, Warren Ludski.